Welcome, Mr. O'Toole and Mr. Kroll, to Division One of the Court of Appeals. Do you want me to review our procedures, or it looks like?
I think I'm fine with it, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kroll, I assume you're, no, they haven't changed recently, so we have experienced counsel. We will dispense with the review of our procedures, but I would just ask that anybody has a cell phone to make sure that it's turned off so it doesn't interrupt us inadvertently. So, and with that, we're ready to go.
Thank you. Your Honor, panel, good afternoon. Mr. Kroll, good afternoon. My name is Neil O'Toole. I'm appearing on behalf of the claimant in this case as the petitioner. I want to beg the court's indulgence. As I stand here today, I have a bit of a cold in my left ear, which has inhibited my hearing. I was trying to, from the back, listen to you, and I thought I heard it fairly well. If I ask you to repeat the question, please excuse me.
Sure.
The issue in this case is the application of Section 8-40-201-19B. This is the establishment of wages under the Workers' Compensation Act. The importance of that particular section is that the wage calculation impacts benefits received by the claimant in at least three different areas. Well, actually four different areas. One would be temporary total disability, 842-105, temporary partial 106, permanent partial 107, and then it's permanent total, but that none of those are at stake here. The question that comes up is whether the claimant had a right in this case to have room and board included as wages, as is mandated by statute. The ALJ and ICAP decided, and I should say ICAP based on the ruling of the ALJ, decided that certain requirements were mandated in order for the claimant to show that the claimant was entitled to room and board as an addition to wages. The first requirement was, and this is again from the ICAP decision and the ALJ's decision, that the claimant has to provide direct evidence of the value of room and board. Now, what goes on is there is a bit of bootstrapping here, because what happens is the claimant puts on evidence about the value of room and board to him when he enters into the contract of hire. That, by the way, is described as why the claimant entered into the contract of hire at RO Record on Appeal at 59 and 60. Because he saw that as a benefit, because his hourly rate would be minimal because he was on call 24 hours a day. Then he goes on, it goes on to say after that, that the determination of room and board must be performed by an analysis of market forces which are comparable to that which was obtaining in this distant post, which is Antarctica. Of course, there's nothing in the statute which says that this is to be determined by comparable market forces. In fact, it simply mandates that the director establish or fix the value of room and board. Now, in this particular case, the only evidence was the value of the room and board to the claimant. Now, this case, interestingly, comes upon an earlier case called Anders, which was never appealed. And I guess what we have is developed in ICAP the Raytheon exception to the room and board rule, because in Anders, what happens is that the claimant gets injured, is sent off to Australia or New Zealand, one is given a per diem, and the ALJ says there's no comparable market in New Zealand, in Antarctica, and as a consequence, the per diem is not relevant. Now, I don't know how, and fully understand how the court rationalized that with this court's opinion in the Kroll case, where it allowed a per diem based on what was paid while the person was in Denver or the person was up in Wyoming. I forget, I think it was Wyoming, I'm pretty sure. And then what it goes on to say, the ICAP says, that, well, you know, there's an artificial society in Antarctica, and if there's an artificial society in Antarctica, how can this be compared to any place? Now, once the claimant has produced a prima facie case, which he did, of the value of him of the contract for hire, it is our position that the requirement to establish or fix the reasonable value rests with the director through its ALJ. Now,
Mr. O'Toole,
yes, Your Honor.
Let me interrupt you. What if Mr. Eiler had testified at the hearing that he was living in Cherry Hills Village and that his monthly rent was $5,000 instead of $500, and that his cost of food was $2,000 a month?
Well, that would have given rise to perhaps a higher average weekly wage, because, of course, it would have been capped as to the maximum TTD rate in effect at that time, and that's the statutory protection.
But my question, though, really is whether the ALJ is required to accept that, or whether the ALJ would have discretion to say, well, that's not comparable because you're living in much more luxurious circumstances in Cherry Hills Village than you were in Antarctica.
It is. Well, aside from the fact that there was a, there's a, by the way, a statutory cap on the TTD rate, the answer to that question is the judge could have still determined what was reasonable. But in this case, there was no attempt to do that. The determination was that not that the value testified to by the claimant was unreasonable, but rather that room and board in Antarctica had no value.
Was there an attempt on the part of the claimant to establish the value of room and board? I understand you put on evidence about a room and board in Arvada and on Fort Collins, but was there an attempt to find out what the employer was paying for room and board on Antarctica?
Unfortunately, the closest that came was the cost of a tourist visiting Antarctica, which came out to be very expensive, where in the unusual circumstances there would be a skiing expedition or, God forget, you know, a marathon at any rate. So that, I mean, that was the closest, and that was in response to cross-examination. So, but indeed, so the claimant did not present any such evidence.
The claimant's burden to put on evidence of the
cost? Once the claimant put on evidence, it's our position that there was adequate evidence to establish this. But the problem is we're not worried about this case being remanded and then the court being said that there does not have to be, this court saying, there does not have to be a comparable market and there does not have to be direct evidence, both of which were mandated by both the ALJ and the Court of Appeals, and I'm sorry, the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, putting the burden onto the claimant, which was far superior than any burden imposed by statute. So did the claimant meet his burden? Of course, we say he did. Once he reached that point, could the court have said, well, I don't find that rent reasonable? Was there any evidence to countervail this? No. Do I recognize that there are cases where there's no countervailing evidence, and of course the ALJ's opinion against the particular claimant is upheld? Yes. But in this particular case, we're dealing with a statutorily protected entitlement where there is a mandate that that this be established by the director. It's not optional, it's a mandatory requirement.
Okay, so if it were mandatory, what if an ALJ could not come up with a reasonable value?
I'm sorry.
You can't hear me? Okay. Do you agree that an ALJ has to come up with a reasonable value?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so...
But in this case,
There was no attempt to do this. Rather, it was stated that room and board has no value. That's how I read the order. That's what it says in a couple of places. So it doesn't have any value because Antarctica, and those are the words that are used, is an artificial society. Now, interestingly, respondents argue in their brief, and that's an interesting argument Mr. Kroll raises, and that is that the claimant really isn't precluded from using other factors. For example, he could put on the cost of military accommodations in remote locations, such as Ranger Quarters, National Forest. But the reality is, that's not what this opinion permits. It says you have to have comparable market forces, and it seems to mean comparable to the location where the services, or I should say the room and board, is provided. There's no such requirement in the statute, and it's our position that that requirement should not be read into the statute, and that the burden to establish this entitlement rests with the ALJ. But the ALJ simply can't shrug off this burden by saying, oh, it can't be compared, particularly as it, you know, and I guess in this particular case, there was a follow on the Anders case, the Raytheon exception to section 8-40-201-19B. So,
and I suppose we agree with you at one level that the ALJ shouldn't have said it's impossible to make a comparison. There's no evidence of value. Did you put on enough for the ALJ to come up with a reasonable value?
Yes.
I guess that's what I'm wrestling
with. Yes, that's what I'm saying. We know from the previous Anders case, one which I tried to distinguish, which is really a failed attempt because the Anders was wrongly decided too. But what happened was, and that's Anders is not your case, it was an appeal. But, you know, yeah, there was enough there for the ALJ to say, yeah, that's a reasonable value of food. I mean, look at the numbers here. Per week, food, $152.31. Look at value of room per week, again, $115.38. This is enough to determine a reasonable value. Yes.
Well, it strikes me that through discovery of the employer, you could have determined what the room value was and what the food value was.
Perhaps. I don't know. Because what I don't know is how the employer would establish the value of all the transport of these various objects and the maintenance of that station. It may end up being a value closer, more akin to Cherry Hill Village than to Arvada in a shared apartment with shared sharing of food. Most likely it is, because getting food there is an expensive process. The amount is to be interesting. How do you split it up between all the people? I don't know. But there has to have a cost. And the important question or statement was, which is made in both opinion, is that it has no value. And that's the ALJ and ICAP. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Toole.
I've reserved 124. I don't know if I'll use it. Thank you.
Okay, very well.
Thank you, Jeff.
Afternoon. May it please the court, David Kroll on behalf of Raytheon Technical Services and Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. The claimant has suggested that the issue is that the ALJ and the Industrial Claims Appeals Office has added some requirements to the workers' compensation statute that's dealing with this average weekly wage issue. And I would assert that the ALJ and the ICAO panel is not doing that. The statute they're construing asks, what is the reasonable value of room and board that can be added to an average weekly wage in a particular case? And in this case, when they, when the ALJ rejected the evidence presented by the claimant, he was doing nothing other than that. The evidence he was presented was the room and board for an individual in Arvada, Colorado, and being asked to say, oh, well, that's also what I should determine the reasonable value of room and board in a frontier outpost in Antarctica is. But he reasonably, he very clearly determined, well, that's not persuasive. That's just too distinct.
Mr. Kroll, at the hearing, Mr. Eiler testified that the one reason that he took the job was because free room and board were offered by Raytheon. Isn't that statement some circumstantial evidence that the room and board had value to him?
I don't disagree that there that you could set a value for the room and board in Antarctica.
Well, if that's so, then didn't the ALJ err in saying there was no value?
Well, I don't think the ALJ. That's not how I read his opinion. I don't think he was saying.
The ALJ said specifically that the claimant had presented no evidence of the value of room and board in Antarctica. Do you read that a different way?
No, I think he said that, but that was a comment on the evidence he had before him. That evidence he was saying was just not useful in determining what value there was to room and board in Antarctica. And I think that's completely different than saying, well, there's no way that you could figure out that value. I think there are some ways, but because of the circumstances of a frontier type of position, that you can't really use Cherry Hill Village, Arvada, Fifth Avenue in Manhattan as evidence of what that value is, because they're just not comparable.
Well, I have trouble following the argument in your brief that there, that Mr. O'Toole referred to, that where you suggested that people working in other remote outposts could be used as a basis. But it seems to me that if Mr. O'Toole that had tried to do that, that you wouldn't have hesitated to object to that on the ground that it was irrelevant because the circumstances in any given remote outpost would be substantially different from those in Antarctica. Am I incorrect?
That I would have objected?
Yes.
I might have made any variety of arguments, but I would submit that if I was a judge, I would think that would be much more useful to know what kind of costs were involved in those remote type of situations. I think it's much more useful than the evidence from Arvada, Colorado that was presented, because that just doesn't seem to be useful at all in figuring out how the value of an apartment in Antarctica would be valued.
Well, let me ask, oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right, the ALJ is required to determine what the wages are, including room and board. And there was evidence here of three meals a day, unlimited snacks, and a room. And so isn't it unreasonable for an ALJ to find that the value of that is zero?
Well, he didn't find, I don't read him as finding that the value in Antarctica was zero. He just was saying the evidence I have would only allow me to speculate or guess as to what the value in Antarctica is, because this really isn't comparable. And of course he shouldn't be in a position where he has to just guess at it. He needs useful evidence, and he's just saying that the evidence of our cost in Arvada was not useful. It was just too distinct and too remote.
But
go ahead. To follow up on what my colleague just asked, the ALJ had evidence of three meals and a room, and the ALJ also had evidence of what something would cost in Arvada for room and board. Did the employer cross-examine the claimant on differences between Arvada and Antarctica, for instance, on room or board?
Well, the claimant didn't, he didn't present any evidence as to, well, any, in any detail as to what he received in the way of board in Antarctica. I mean, all that was specified was meat and vegetables, sandwiches and casseroles, I think it was, not indicating it was anything more than ground beef or putrid frozen vegetables. And he didn't, and of course, he didn't offer anything in regard to the details of what he bought in Arvada either.
But Mr. Kroll, isn't that something that you might have cross-examined about, for example, to ask if Mr. Eiler was eating filet mignon every night in Arvada and eating hamburger helper every night in Antarctica, just to, as a hypothetical?
Well, I certainly could have. I chose not to. It was his burden of proof, and when I saw that it wasn't being met, I didn't want to help him out. And so the record really doesn't give the ALJ, once again, any details in regard to the comparison of what Mr. Eiler was eating in Antarctica as opposed to what he was buying in Arvada.
Mr. Eiler did say, although albeit brief, that both the lodging and the board were comparable or similar to what his conditions were in Antarctica.
Well, actually, that was his conclusion, but what he stated was that his conditions in Antarctica were a military-style dorm room, whereas he was indicated in Arvada he lived in a house with at least one room and possibly even more than that, and he didn't have to share his room in Arvada with anyone else, where he did, for a good part of the time, have to share his dorm room in Antarctica. So actually, the record, I think, does show that there were probably some distinctions just on the surface of the accommodations he had in Arvada as opposed to those in Antarctica, let alone the situation of living in a forbidden, frozen frontier area. So actually, I think the evidence on many points was probably that it was just too distinct to and not useful to be able to compare the costs of these items in Arvada with those in Antarctica. And I don't think the characterization by counsel is correct that the ALJ was adding anything to the statute. I think he was just applying it as it was stated. He's supposed to find the reasonable value of this room and board. And to do that, he is going to need some evidence other than the evidence of a cost of room and board in a prosperous suburb in Denver, Colorado, as opposed to a very cold, forbidden posting in Antarctica.
Let me follow up on a question that Judge Roman asked Mr. O'Toole. Would it have been possible or feasible for Mr. Eiler to have subpoenaed someone from Raytheon to testify as to the cost or value of room and board in Antarctica?
That was certainly something he could have done. I don't know what the evidence would have shown because he didn't do it. I mean, there's probably any variety of ways that a counsel could approach the evidence in that case. I mean, I suggested in my brief a couple ways. You could look at some frontier outposts. You could compare the costs just in wages of doing, like if Mr. Eiler was washing dishes in Antarctica, what it would cost to also wash dishes, or what he'd be paid to wash dishes in Arvada, use that ratio, apply it to the difference in housing costs, and present it that way. You could look at evidence of other frontier outposts. You could look at the evidence of what it costs Raytheon to feed and house individuals in Antarctica. I mean, these are all theoretical because I don't know exactly what the ALJ was looking for. I do know that he did not find that the cost of these items in Arvada was useful to determine the value in Antarctica.
Could the ALJ have assumed that the cost of board was, if anything, more expensive in Antarctica because everything all the food would have had to have been shipped to Antarctica?
That, I mean, that very well could have been, and whether the ALJ wanted to just use the cost of the employer as the reasonable value of room and board, I mean, that would be up to him. And so that's certainly a possibility. I just have no idea what it costs for Raytheon to provide that room and board in Antarctica. If there are no further questions, then I will rest at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Kroll.
I have nothing further unless the court has questions.
Thank you, Mr. O'Toole. Thank you again, Mr. Kroll. We appreciate your arguments in this unusual and interesting case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the arguments this afternoon for Division.